Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at ArmorAll.com. Armor All, less work, more clean. Terms apply.
The Athletic.
The race is on, and Max Verstappen took his third win of the season in Formula One's inaugural Miami Grand Prix. And for the second race in succession, he overtook world championship rival Charles Leclerc to do it. But what happened to Ferrari's challenge, and was F1's newest and glitziest race all about style over substance? I'm Ed Straw, and joining me to answer those questions and many more are Scott Mitchell and Mark Hughes. Well, Scott, how have you enjoyed your first trip to Miami?
Yeah, really enjoyed it. I've been to America a few times now for work, Formula One and Formula E. So I've visited Austin, I've visited Long Beach, but this is my first time in this part of the country. And Miami's been awesome, packed in. My first baseball game, went to see some NBA, got to see my beloved Philadelphia 76ers lose in pretty dramatic fashion. Well, I say dramatic fashion, quite pathetic fashion to the Miami Heat, which was awesome. Tried some Cuban food, went, checked out some local eateries, and yeah, just really enjoyed it. And the event itself was pretty spectacular, off track anyway, maybe on track a little bit less so. We'll get into that a bit later, but yeah, as a, in general, really enjoyed it. Miami's been pretty cool.
And you didn't even mention beating me at pool.
The inaugural East Hollywood Miami Pool Cup ended in a resounding 3-1 victory for this guy right here. So we're about to talk about a bunch of elite athletes on this podcast, but I count myself in that group after my stellar pool performance the other night.
You almost broke a window during it. That's how spectacular it was. And Mark, you've had a similar experience to Scott in Miami, but might this be a race that you really do have to be here for to get the best out of?
As an experience, yeah. I mean, it's a great place to be. This part of the world, it's, the weather, and you go down to Miami Marina, the Miami Beach there, and it's just it's lovely, and it's just the place has got a buzz about it, especially with the event coming here this weekend. It had an extra buzz, and yeah, it was a bit more than just a Grand Prix. It was I think something that sort of like the aspiration of Liberty is to have this sort of, you know, event which sort of transcends just the traditional following of the sport, and it's sort of catering to a newer audience, I think. But at the same time, I don't think there's anything about it that would alienate the existing audience. I thought it was a great event.
Well, let's get into the race then, Mark. On Saturday, Ferrari locked out the front row, but on Sunday, Red Bull had the edge with Verstappen overtaking Leclerc for the lead on lap 9. So, as per tradition, can you explain how the race was won?
Yeah, I think at the end of the weekend, we could look back and say that actually the Red Bull was the faster car, but it took all of the weekend for it to become apparent, because it's still a little bit delicate, still a little bit high maintenance. And losing most of Friday track run into various reliability problems meant that Max was on the back foot in qualifying, and he just wasn't as dialed into the car as the two Ferrari drivers were into theirs. And he was just pushing a little bit too hard through turn 6, I think it was, and it just got away from him and just ran a bit wide. And that's what basically took him out of contention for pole. But I think it's a small enough difference between the two cars still that that was enough to, you know, to enable Ferrari to lock out the front row. But it's got one thing going for it, which is had all year, and it's a very, very strong end of straight speed. And that in combination with the Ferrari's pushing the front right medium tire, working that tire a bit harder than the Red Bull tends to, which is, we saw that in Imola as well. That combination just allowed Verstappen to get in front. He dealt with Sainz by turn two. And in a way, it was probably as well that he'd qualified third rather than second, because third was definitely a better grid slot here than second. Also a bit like Imola, actually. And so that was that prevented Sainz from being a barrier to Leclerc, prevented Ferrari from being able to use Sainz as a barrier. And then he just wore Leclerc down. Leclerc's tire began opening up. Max went through, and that looked to be it. He pulled out enough of a gap that he didn't need to worry about any undercut threat. And then it was all thrown up in the air a bit by that late safety car, and then he had to be defensive, because for the same reason that the Ferrari is a bit harder on the front tire, it also warms the front tire up more quickly. So for those first couple of post safety car laps, Leclerc was all over him and really brought the race back to life. By the time DRS was enabled a couple of laps later, Max had got his tyres up to temperature, and then that was it, straightforward from there.
Yeah, and one notable thing during the weekend was Verstappen giving Red Bull a hard time for little procedure errors and bits and pieces that made life difficult for him. He had a little bite of that after the race as well. I think that's poorly attached hydraulic line in FP2 that led to the problems with him not being able to steer properly and the brake fire. Didn't go down very well with him, so felt a bit under pressure, but did manage to turn it around on the Sunday. Now, Scott, as ever, we have questions from the Race Members Club. The first comes from Matt Wyatt, who has a strategy question. He asks, could Ferrari have put Verstappen under more pressure by pitting Leclerc under the safety car? I think Leclerc had enough of a gap to Perez during the VSC to make it work, but might have needed Sainz to let him chase after Max following the restart. I feel like Ferrari missed an opportunity there, as an overtake never looked likely without a tyre offset or a mistake from Max. There is a secondary question in there about what tyres Leclerc had left, which I'll answer while you're thinking about that, Scott, because he had no mediums left at all, but he did have a set of fresh hards available as well as some used softs.
Yeah, well, that's what I was going to say. I see where Matt's coming from, but because Leclerc didn't have a set of mediums available beyond the fresh ones he started on, he only had new hards and used softs. So Ferrari felt that sticking with the used hard was the best option. Even a fresh set of softs would have been too risky, and the warm up on the hards too difficult. So I actually think Ferrari played it right, and Leclerc clearly had enough pace to put pressure on. He just didn't quite have enough. And by doing what they did, Ferrari anchored a double podium. They briefly challenged for the win as well with just what simply looked like being the slightly slower race car.
Probably they benefited as well from having Leclerc out there staying on the same set of tyres, because he did have a little bit of a chance towards the end. So no bad thing at all. Now, Mark, we also have some questions about the relative strengths and the development paths of the Ferrari and the Red Bull. I'm going to put two questions together for you to ponder. Sander van Hulten asks if Ferrari is likely to solve its lack of top speed without compromising downforce levels, while Oscar Robledo asks if the Red Bull design philosophy with a little downforce sacrifice for straight line speed will be optimal for the forthcoming races, or is Ferrari's approach the better one?
It's going to depend on the track, and I don't think that quite right, the pattern that you see, that is how it is, but I think that's just defined by the concept of the cars. I don't think it's a Red Bull choosing to go light, you know, in terms of setup. I don't think it's a setup choice as they come into a weekend. I think it's a car concept choice, and that's just how it's going to play out. If you run the car in the most efficient manner on the Red Bull, it's got relatively little wing. On the Ferrari, it's got quite a lot of wing. And that's just how each of those cars works best. And so that is what you're going to see. And so, yes, that does tend to make the Red Bull a bit more raceable, even though it will depend on the track layout whether it's ultimately faster over a lap than a Ferrari. That's as they stand at the moment. But having said that, I do think in the last couple of races, Red Bull do seem to be chipping away on the development front. And it was certainly a concern that Mattia Binotto was expressing after the race. He's a little bit concerned that they're putting performance on that car, and he's very aware that they need to get some performance on their own car, and is hopeful that it will be at Barcelona. But this is the first time we've seen the Red Bull was not losing out on acceleration to the Ferrari. Perhaps that weight savings playing a part in that. And it's still retained its stronger end of straight speed and wasn't losing out on acceleration. So I think overall that made it the stronger car.
And of course, we might see a little bit of a change in the balance of power next race at Barcelona, because Barcelona is always a good place for upgrades, isn't it?
Yeah, indeed. And it's also places a lot of emphasis on the sort of corners that the Ferrari is very good at. So, let's just see. But I think, looking back in hindsight, the Miami track did suit the Red Bull, but the Red Bull is coming on. It is, being developed quite well.
Yeah, let's move into Division 2, as it were, for the front-running battle. Scott, it did seem we might be preparing Carlos Sainz's sympathy corner at one stage in the weekend after he had his crash on Friday, but he recovered well, ended up finishing third. Do you think he's at least steadied the ship now?
Yeah, I think so. I think he did a decent job. He trailed Leclerc in qualifying the whole way through, actually. He looked a chunk away, but then he pulled it together when it mattered in Q3. It actually looked like he might grab pole at one point. He was on a good lap. But as the lap progressed, Leclerc just edged further and further away. Sainz still pipped Verstappen to second, but I did actually wonder if that was a sign of Carlos learning from the mistakes he'd made, first in Imola, in qualifying there, and then in practice here. And he was just building up a little bit, gaining his confidence, getting everything together to push when it mattered, because it had become clear in the last couple of events that the limit of that car is not quite where he thought it was. So I did wonder if that was a bit deliberate. As for the race, he was pretty powerless to stop Verstappen into turn one at the start. But to be fair, he fought as hard as he could without being unfair. His race was pretty clean. A slow pit stop didn't help, but after that was looking fine. I thought he was pretty safe in third place, obviously helped by the fact that Perez had been slowed by a brief engine issue. Then after the safety car at the restart, he had to withstand massive pressure from Perez, who had switched to a set of fresh mediums. But he did that excellently. He defended brilliantly into the first corner. I really thought Perez was going to have him on the outside there with a bit more grip, but Sainz did a great job there, judged that really well. And then he just sort of kept him at arm's length. He just did everything he needed to do. He brought home a podium after a perfectly decent competitive Grand Prix, despite struggling with the combination of feeling sore from his Friday crash and not having done a race distance for about a month. So I think it was a really solid result and probably just what he needed.
Yeah, he needed something like that, didn't he? Mark, Chris Parrott from the Race Members Club asks, is Carlos Sainz's championship challenge over? 104 points for Leclerc, 53 for Sainz.
Well, I mean, it's easy for it to feel like that from the perspective of now, but just five races in, things can happen. But yeah, I think obviously he's got a mountain to climb, really, if he's to make himself get himself in a position where Ferrari can't just automatically at halfway point of the season say, okay, you're now in support role. It's going to be very tough, but it just just takes a Leclerc retirement and a Sainz win, for example, and it looks a little bit less. That such things aren't beyond the imagination. So I wouldn't be writing it off, but I would say it's very, very difficult.
Yeah, it's hard, especially with the form very much being with Leclerc. But then again, Sainz will take some solace from the fact he was actually ahead of Leclerc for quite a big chunk of that qualifying lap, and it only was really decided in Leclerc's favour by that big bit of wheel spin that Sainz had out of turn 17. So Sainz kind of desperately trying to hang on there. And ultimately, Scott, Checo Perez, fourth place. You'll be a little bit disappointed with that. He almost got that position off Sainz, but still another solid result for him, isn't it? That's what he's there to do.
Yeah, I think he's I think he's performing very well. He is pretty much making the Red Bull decision for next year a no-brainer, isn't he? I don't see how Red Bull or why Red Bull would replace him when he is performing at exactly the level that they've been trying to get a second driver to perform at since Daniel Ricciardo left. So, yeah, I don't think there's any real issues with Perez's performances at the moment. Maybe there is still a little bit of a question mark on him over one lap, but I think that will always be there. The main point is that at the moment, when the cars are nice and finely balanced in terms of the Ferrari versus Red Bull fight, Perez can be counted on. He is always there or thereabouts. Okay, that qualifying issue probably won't ever disappear, but you don't have any concern that Perez is going to be, you know, having to fight his way out of 8th or 9th in every other Grand Prix or something like that. So I think Red Bull are pretty happy with him.
Yeah, and his race was made a little bit harder by that brief spell where he did have a bit of an engine problem. I think that was a sensor issue that cost him a little bit of power, and it took them a tiny bit of time to sort that out, which inevitably cost him some time in that first stint.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Well, Mark, let's talk Mercedes now. On Friday, the W13 had a new lower downforce rear wing, crucially lower drag as well, a modified beam wing and changes to the front wing and end plates, with George Russell setting the pace in FP2. Looked close to Red Bull and Ferrari on long run pace as well. And yet, come qualifying, Hamilton and Russell were 6th and 12th, with Hamilton just over 8/10 off. Then they took 5th and 6th in the race. So was that just reading too much into Friday, or was there something a little bit more interesting going on here?
No, they were genuinely quick on Friday, and they, for reasons that they really don't understand, with almost identical settings to Friday in qualifying, they were nowhere, and the track had gripped up a lot. All the other cars sort of found a second a lap from the increased track grip, but all the increased track grip seemed to do to the Mercedes was trigger it back into the porpoising behaviour. And it seems a very, very sensitive threshold. Whatever's triggering it, all that had changed between Friday and qualifying was the track, with the level of track grip. The car was virtually identical in setup. They'd gone to a lower ride height in FP3 in between those sessions on Saturday morning, and that had triggered. Oh, the car then was in bad shape, and they believed, fairly logically, I suppose, that it was because they'd been a little bit too greedy with the ride height. So they came back up, back to where they were in time for qualifying, assuming that it would behave like it had on Friday, but it just didn't, and it didn't at any other point in the weekend either. So yeah, it's that threshold can be triggered by even just changes in track grip. So by a mechanism, through a mechanism by which the team itself doesn't yet understand.
Yeah, still plenty of work to be done there. George Russell was saying after the race they need to really understand what happened on Friday in case that might give them a bit of an extra direction to understand things. But, yeah, still trying to get to the bottom of it properly. To be fair, they never expected the upgrades that they brought to change things completely. They were all good tweaks, but they weren't game changers, and that proved to be the case. They're just that little feeling that maybe on Friday they might be, but then, of course, the performance patterns changed. A few questions from the race members. Club George Willis asked, should Mercedes have brought Lewis in for softs under the safety car? Do they still play strategy too safe? I think I'll take that one and say they could have done. I think it was one of those ones that they could have gone either way, really, which is, I think, why they gave Lewis Hamilton that option. He'd lost a place to George Russell. Probably wouldn't have made a great deal of difference in the end, in the grand scheme of things. But ultimately, the two Mercedes drivers got past Valtteri Bottas, didn't they? So I don't think we can really complain about that strategy. They weren't going to do any better than what they did. Question from Oscar Robledo, who says, has Mercedes genuinely found some pace, or were they flattered by the track and conditions today? Now, Mark, that's, I think, referring to the race pace. We've kind of seen this before, haven't we, for Mercedes, that they're a little bit struggling in qualifying, but in race pace, they often settle into being kind of the third fastest or thereabouts.
I think on, yeah, if you able, if the conditions are able to, the circumstances of a race are able to let you see the actual potential of every car, yeah, I think the Mercedes is still, yeah, it vies, or here it was vying with the Alfa Romeo's third fastest car. But there's no, I wouldn't say its performance in the race was any better than it had been in the previous four races. It was, had there not been a safety car, it would have finished, you know, miles behind. It was just the safety car that had brought it up, you know, relatively close.
You know, similar Imola, wasn't it, with Mercedes probably the fourth fastest car in that race in the end, but Alfa Romeo in that general neighbourhood as well. So, yeah, I don't think we saw a transformed performance pattern there. Scott, Simon T asks, do you think Barcelona will be make or break for this Mercedes concept? If they're still scratching their heads five races in with the technical minds and resources they have, might it be time for a U-turn?
I think the upcoming Spanish Grand Prix and a return to the track where the old concept ran in testing is key. I think it will be very important to Mercedes deciding whether it has got its concept right or wrong. Mercedes F1 boss Toto Wolff hasn't completely ruled out a return to the older car specification, but that felt like it was much more Toto not wanting to absolutely rule something out on the off chance it is the route they have to go down. He said that the team is still committed to the current concept for now. What Toto has acknowledged is that the team introduced a significant upgrade at the second test in Bahrain that minimised its side pods considerably. And this is where the Mercedes car design varies most from its rivals. Obviously, there are bound to be other elements of the concept that are unique, but this is the most obvious. Wolff said that it means the floor edges stick out much wider than everyone else's, and he says that gives it much more scope for possible instability. But he's adamant that the original version of the W13, with its more conventional side pods, is much slower on paper. So when he was asked if there could be a scenario where Mercedes goes back to the current concept, he talked about that and said that he wants to give the benefit of the doubt to the engineering team. They believe that this is the route they need to go down. But he also acknowledged that Barcelona is going to be a point in time where they have to correlate what they've seen in February, in the first test there, with the old concept, and gather more data. He keeps saying the same thing, gathering data, making experiments, used a nice phrase where he said it's physics, not mystics. But ultimately, Wolff has hinted that if Mercedes doesn't believe its car design could be made to work, then it will abandon it. Like I said, it's not the case at the moment. It's currently being faithful to the current concept, but the significance of combing through the data gathered so far to understand why the car's porpoising so badly and how to get that under control is still absolutely key. There will eventually come a point where if Mercedes can't do that, then they will have to basically determine that the concept isn't as good in reality as it is on paper. But that is still a very complex situation, because until they actually understand why that is, they can't make that decision. We talked about this on a previous podcast. We've gone into that in a lot of detail, but it's a tricky situation for Mercedes to be in. And every race that ticks by, I think, does just widen that door ever so slightly more to a potential experiment of going back to the old concept.
Yeah, it does seem to be about the amount of floor exposed there is there, and it flexing and moving around and a few other little problems it's causing. So that'll be the big question. Barcelona will be important. Mark, Simon T also asks, what is it about the Mercedes and switching the tyres on? Unless I'm mistaken, they've struggled a lot with this over the years, and it's the same again with these new cars.
Yeah, I mean, historically, they used to struggle with overheating of the rears. And it was then when they got into the hybrid era, the car was so superior that any sort of funny tyre traits were sort of, you know, weren't important. And then it's always been slightly unusual in how it used the tyres, it's true. And it, for example, traditionally, when compared to when it was racing a competitive Ferrari in 17, 18 or a competitive Red Bull, it tended not to find as much time from them on the softest tires. So it's always hard to slow. It's just, yeah. I mean, no team will understand in. You'd need everybody's information in terms of suspension kinematics and, you know, the dynamic weight distribution, how it changes with the aero maps to fully do a comparison and understand it. So each team only understands their own car if they're lucky, and they can't fully understand everybody else's. So it's hard to answer that definitively, but you're right. It's always been a little bit offset compared to the norm in how it uses the tyres. And this one is a little bit too gentle on the tyres for qualifying, and which can be a boon in the race. And we see the opposite with this Ferrari. For example, it seems to switch its tyres on very well, better than the Red Bull, certainly this weekend. But if the compound's a little bit soft, it can overwork the front. And that's what we saw in the last two races. So the Mercedes is more like the Red Bull in that respect, but more so. It's gentler on the tyres over. It's more reluctant to get them up to temperature over a single lap, but is relatively gentle on them in a race.
Yeah, and before we finish on Mercedes, we should, of course, mention that we ended up with George Russell finishing fifth ahead of Lewis Hamilton in that race. A little bit fortuitous with the safety car. Actually, it was only really in his battle with his teammate that the safety car made much of a difference for Russell, because his pace compared to the cars behind was very, very good, even advanced in that stint. So, yeah, just had one of those days when the two positions flips around. I'm sure there'll be somebody arguing that this just shows that that Lewis Hamilton's passed it and George Russell is better than him. But this is one of those ones where Russell struggled a bit in qualifying and had a little bit of a little bit of luck in the race. But ultimately, they ended up finishing together. Well, more on the Miami Grand Prix in a moment. But first, it's time to check on the race's Grid Rival League. Grid Rival is a fancy motorsport game that offers you the chance to pick a team of five drivers and one team. But with the added challenge and opportunity of juggling the length of time they remain on your roster and how best to spend your budget, the race has its own league, which you can join in order to become one of many, many people who are currently beating me and Scott. So how's your team got on this week, Scott?
Pretty solidly. I scored 896 points this week. I've moved up to 440th position, which is not very impressive, but you know, I'll take a green arrow. I think it was solid. I think it would have been a very good week, but unfortunately, I was let down by the Haas duo. I had Alonso, Leclerc, Bottas and Red Bull were the other slots in my roster, and I had Alonso as my star driver, so he did okay for me, but obviously his penalties I think hurt. But it was really the late slumps for the Haas duo that really cost me. We'll talk about this in a bit more detail shortly, but Mick Schumacher falling out of a points position and Kevin Magnussen falling back as well. So I think it would have been a very good week, but in the end it turned into sort of a just slightly above average.
Yeah, I got 951 points, not too bad. I've still got race winner Max Verstappen, Kevin Magnussen, Carlos Sainz and Ferrari. My new signings were Fernando Alonso and for one race only Mick Schumacher. Those didn't work out so well in the end. I had Alonso as my double points talent driver, so his dual penalties that dropped him out of the points were not very helpful. Top of the races league overall now is SIR 44 with a total of 5,134 points and a tremendously strong lineup of Magnussen, Bottas, Verstappen, Sainz and Alonso plus Ferrari. We'll be continuing to track the progress over the year, so download the Grid Rival app or visit the website so you can join in. You'll find the link in the episode description for this podcast. Now, Scott, let's talk Valtteri Bottas. He was resoundingly fifth for most of the race, but after the safety car, he had a wide moment and dropped behind the two Mercedes drivers. What was his excuse for that?
Yeah, I think he found the restart a bit tricky. he had used his tyres pretty hard before that, and obviously we know that the restart had the safety car had been kind for Russell in terms of being able to make his change of tyres, rejoin, have a nice run basically at Bottas and Hamilton. So Russell was absolutely on the offensive. Bottas knew that he was under pressure and he basically just made a small mistake. He overshot the last corner, only by a small amount, but it's obviously so dusty offline or dirty offline that people were complaining about the surface all weekend. That's the nature of the track. There's no grip out there. So Bottas was just pushing. Think he'd been a little bit on the ragged edge for a little bit before that. I don't think that was just how he was driving. I think that was in response to the situation. I think he knew that he had to really lean on it to stay ahead of the Mercedes. They were closing quickly. He went a bit too deep, and that was pretty much it. He felt he was unlucky. I don't think it was bad luck. I think it was a misjudgment and a mistake. But it's a mistake that's kind of understandable, because in those circumstances, you really are pushing. He's got two faster cars bearing down on him. I completely understand why he'd want to stay in front of them as well. It's his old team. So I don't begrudge him that too much. But yeah, it's one of those where he's finished seventh and it's a good result. It shows where Valtteri and Alfa Romeo are at the moment, that they can be disappointed with a result like that and falling behind two Mercedes. But at the same time, Bottas needs to be doing a slightly better job there, because there was a better result on the table. So I don't think everything Bottas does is perfect at the moment, but let's put it this way. We are a long, long, long way from the days of Valtteri Bottas' sympathy corner.
Exactly, yes. And yeah, I watched the few laps of the restart before he had that off, and he had a few little wide moments. The pressure was telling, but Alfa Romeo felt they did have the third quickest car, and probably without the safety car, he'd have held on to that position, because every time the Mercedes drivers, Hamilton particularly, was closing in on him, the gap would then stabilise and it would ebb and flow. So I think he had it pretty well covered. Bottas has got 30 points so far this season, but most races there were reasons why he could have got a few more points. Not always his fault, but retirement in Saudi Arabia and was unlucky in Imola. So that just shows how strong a season Alfa Romeo is having. Mark, Esteban Ocon, he couldn't run in qualifying after hitting the wall at turn 14 and punching the suspension through the monocoque. So how did he come to finish eighth from the back?
He did a lovely drive, actually. Put on a set of hards, got them to last forever, a bit like George Russell. And he made good progress during that time. But cementing the deal was the safety car, which allowed him, just like Russell, to get in and get a very time cheap pit stop, and that just cemented his position. And then his teammate Alonso was penalised 5 seconds, and that put him behind him in the official results. So he ninth across the line and eighth official. So yeah, really, really good performance from the back of the grid.
Yeah, Esteban Ocon said he was at about 50% after that battering he took in that crash. So he was actually very, very pleased that he could come away with a few points. I think he expected it to be very, very, very difficult, but one of those ones where it all came to him. I did ask him where he was struggling in terms of the after effects, and he said it was the knees mainly, but also the lower back, a little bit of bruising. So 51G impact for him. Good effort from Ocon to come back from that. Scott, Fernando Alonso. Mark's already alluded to this, very much in the wars during the race. Had a bit of contact with Hamilton on the first lap. Eighth on the road, got a brace of penalties that shuffled him out of the points. So can you run through his catalogue of incidents?
I can. I think we should start with the positives. He made a great start. He actually, I believe him. This is a little bit of a Fernando Alonsoism, where he extols his own virtues, basically.
Did he make the greatest start in human history?
No, but he was incredibly, incredibly intelligent, and he noticed something that nobody else could possibly have noticed, with a fantastic piece of awareness on what he described as the slowest parade lap in history, when the drivers are going around. I think this time they were in sports cars, weren't they? And he said that he basically took inspiration from that lap as they were going through turn one. He said he had about 20 or 30 seconds to just survey the circuit, and he noticed that on the outside line, effectively, like what is the racing line, and then a little bit wider into the first corner was looked really nicely rubbered in. Didn't look like there was much dirt or gravel on that. So he basically sort of committed in his mind at the start that if the gap opened up, he could really attack on the outside, and that's exactly what he did. He had a little bit of contact with Hamilton as the track then bends round to the left, and while he didn't pass in that exact moment, Lewis did seem to sort of then back off slightly as they come through the right-hander, probably just because the car's a little bit then offline and a little bit unsettled. And then Alonso swept around the outside. So that's a little bit cheeky, but he got away with that. What was far more than cheeky was the misjudged move on Gasly. Alonso did take responsibility for that. He got a 5-second penalty, which it was the first of the two penalties that ultimately dropped him from 8th to 9th in the first instance. He did take responsibility. He sought out. I watched him go over to Gasly. He apologised to Gasly in front of me. But I actually think he feels that Gasly sort of took a slightly odd line into the first corner and invited an attack and then turned in at, like, normal. And the suggestion from Otmar Szafnauer, the Alpine team boss, was that if Gasly had driven a normal line into the corner, then Alonso would never have been tempted to overtake. But I think that's Fernando sort of apologising, being gracious because he's already been penalised, but secretly thinking that he wasn't actually in the wrong at all. And then he had two leaving the track and gaining an advantage investigations. The second came to nothing, but the first one he was guilty. That was the second 5-second penalty, which dropped into 11th out of the points. I actually think this might be a little bit harsh, but I'd be interested actually to hear your respective positions on it. Basically, the penalty was because Alonso had gone off track at the turn 14 chicane and gaining, obviously, what the stewards felt was a lasting advantage. He, approaching the chicane, he was 2 seconds behind Bottas and half a second clear of Mick Schumacher. Having cut the chicane, Alonso went purple in sector two. The gap to Bottas was cut to about 1.1 seconds and the gap to Schumacher rose to 1.5 seconds. So in total, he's gained about a second to the car in front and behind, give or take. So it's clearly a pretty chunky gain. But as they come out of that, the tight left-hander that then leads down that penultimate straight, he raised his hand. He backed off. You can see that because the lap time falls away. And he fell to about 1.7 seconds behind Bottas, while the gap to Schumacher dropped from 1.5 seconds to around 1.2. And the reason the gap to Schumacher didn't drop by as much as it should have, given how much Alonso backed off, was because I think Schumacher had a slightly bad exit off the corner and then he came under attack from cars behind. So anyway, the point is, Alonso acknowledged it. He made a legitimate effort to give some time back. He sacrificed the vast majority of that time. The gap to Bottas, he didn't sacrifice around sort of, I guess, 0.3 of a second or something like that. And he's been given a 5-second penalty for that. I haven't seen any evidence that there was anything else there that contributes to that. To me, that feels a little bit harsh. I'm guessing they're just going zero tolerance on any time gained at all by going off track. What do you two think?
I guess that purple sector was what did it for him. What do you think, Mark?
Oh, I think he's been the victim of outrageous misfortune. As has happened so many times before, I don't think he did anything particularly wrong, but yeah, setting the purple probably alerted everyone. Big flashing purple on the screen. Had it not been for that, they might have just not bothered looking.
But he did. It's useful though, isn't it? Because Mark was speaking slightly tongue in cheek, but it's a nice little addition to the catalogue of Alonso woe in the opening races, isn't it? So by the time we roll around to Spain and he's in the press conference there, he's going to have another thing to talk about on Friday about how he's been absolutely superb this season and luck just isn't on his side.
The thing is, he does have a bit of a point on some of these things. He's still operating at a very
high
level. He
has a ridiculously low number of championship points, doesn't he, this season, considering how... But I think he's almost got as many licence points this season now as he does championship points.
Yeah, he's got 2 points, hasn't he? That's his sum total for the year. And he ended up missing out on points by 0.102. That's how much Lance Stroll beat him by in that virtual battle for 10th. So yeah, very unfortunate start to the season for Fernando Alonso. Mark, Alex Albon, he was pretty quick in practice, but Williams struggled massively to get the tyres in the window in qualifying, so he was down in 18th on the grid. He ended up 9th after benefiting from Alonso's double penalty and also some late incidents. We've got a question from Oscar Robledo, who asks, given that Alex Albon has scored points twice in the last 3 races, are we seeing the revival of Williams' fortunes?
No, I don't think so. I think we're seeing a very high level of performance from Alex, and he's pulling results out that probably flatter the car, and really Williams has for me, one of the most disappointing teams of the season, given the progress that they were making and the clean sheet that the new regulations represented. I thought we might see something a bit more sort of occasional mid-grid from them, but he can pull a lap out and, you know, just about get it into Q2, and from that position he can sometimes get in the lower points. But for me, they're very much Albon performances rather than Williams performances.
He's looking very, very assured and confident and in control this year. He actually looks like quite a different person in a way to what he was at Red Bull. And it's great to see, because we all know how good he can be. And I wasn't certain whether he'd start to fulfill that potential this year. And he really has done. And Williams have got a very fine driver on their hands now because of that. He actually reckoned that this weekend the performance of the Williams was a chunk better than it had been in Australia. So this was a better weekend and rewarded with that extra point to take it to 2 points.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes.
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Well, Scott, let's talk Mick Schumacher. The Haas driver was in the mix for his first points finish at last, but he had a late clash with his friend and mentor, Sebastian Vettel. What did you make of it? And could this be a time for Mick Schumacher's sympathy corner for the first time?
Yeah, I think so. I talked on the post-Imola podcast about how Schumacher was struggling up against Magnussen, and this was his first real test, and he just wasn't passing it. But in the build-up to this race, team boss Günther Steiner said that Schumacher had to be perfect to score points in such a competitive midfield, and that his first top 10 was a hurdle that needed to be cleared, the implication being that the lack of a points finish might be weighing on Mick a little bit, and he just needs to get that monkey off his back. But he came close to doing exactly that. This was comfortably his best performance of the season, and I think, by extension, the most impressive drive of a short F1 career, at least until the start of lap 54, so close to the end, when he'd been defending from, I think it was an attack from Ocon, wasn't it, into the last corner. He got a little bit of a slide that allowed Vettel to dive past. Mick then tucked in right behind him, going down the start finish straight, and then launched a fairly aggressive move into the first corner. He did come from a little bit behind, but Vettel clearly didn't expect it or see him, turned in to the apex, and Mick clattered into him on the right hand side. Quite a violent impact. Vettel's car briefly airborne, and he retired. Schumacher limped back to the pits. If losing a first ever points finish wasn't enough, to do it by colliding with a longtime family friend and mentor who he's become so close to in recent years clearly exacerbated the pain. You could hear it in Mick's voice. He almost didn't want to protest, because I think he knew instantly who he'd hit. But watching the replay back a few times just after it happened, the more I watched it, the more I became convinced that Mick hadn't actually been too ambitious with that move. I thought it was a legitimate move to make. I thought he did quite a good job in terms of the positioning of the car. He did seem that he was getting the car slowed down enough. He did get nicely alongside Vettel without being out of control. But it's just one of those things that by the time they're at that point of contact, Mick's fully committed on the inside, fully loaded up, can't slow the car down anymore. Sebastian's already committed to his entry point for the corner, and he's heading for the apex. So he could turn out of it, but I don't think he's seen Mick or expecting him. So in the end, I kind of thought, actually, I think this is going to get struck off as a racing incident. And that's exactly what happened. I think I don't really think the stewards could have come to another conclusion, especially with the way they've redone the racing rules guideline for this year. The argument would have been that Mick should have been afforded space on the inside. But yeah, just a gut-wrenching way for Mick to miss out on what was was surely going to be a first points finish in Formula One.
Yeah, he ended up 15th in the end. Schumacher one place better off than Kevin Magnussen, who had a mixed weekend. He had radio problems in Q1 and ended up just going out and driving around and couldn't quite make it through to Q2, and actually had quite a good first part of the race, got past Ricciardo and Tsunoda, then got team ordered past Schumacher briefly, but that stop put him in amongst Aston Martins and it all got a little bit messy. And then he decided he was going to take tyres at the safety car, and that didn't make things easy for him, and he ended up having a collision with Stroll, getting a penalty, and 16th. Very action-packed for Magnussen.
Yeah, well, just Haas in general at the end. My grid rival team thanks them.
Exactly. They're just there to spite you. Let's talk Aston Martin, Mark. Vettel lost a points finish to that incident, but teammate Lance Stroll did grab 10th place after the Alonso penalties. That exciting virtual finish I mentioned. Of course, difficult for Aston Martin because they qualified by their standards relatively well, with Lance Stroll getting to Q3 and Vettel almost getting there with that late Q2 lap, made a small mistake and didn't get through. But they had to start from the pits because they had the fuel to cool. You can only be within, you have to be within 10 degrees C of the ambient temperature, and their fuel was just too cool. And of course, cool fuel, denser, more power, etc. So they had to let it warm up a little bit before joining. But do you think there's any signs of Aston Martin getting better, given that they were maybe fractionally better than they normally were this weekend?
Yeah, I mean, aside from the fuel cooling issue, they were probably, it's probably the most competitive they've been. Lance got through to Q3 on merit, and he did a very decent race from the pit lane to get that point. It's okay through the slow corners. They're having to run it pretty high, so I think if you took this car to Barcelona, it would be a disaster. But they've got a big upgrade coming to Barcelona, so maybe it won't be. I think probably it was just track characteristics, but it was probably its least uncompetitive showing this year.
That's as generous as you can be, but they'll be hoping to have a fresh start with that upgrade that you mentioned. Well, Scott, let's move on to McLaren. They didn't have the best weekend, struggled a bit on a circuit with more slower corners, perhaps wasn't a surprise. Daniel Ricciardo ended up dropping from 11th to 13th after he got a 5-second penalty for gaining an advantage by leaving the track. Incidentally, after the race, he had no idea what that was for, said he was going to go and have a look. Amusingly, he said he didn't really mind because dropping from 11th to 13th doesn't matter, but of course he could have got a point with the subsequent Alonso penalty had he stayed there. Lando Norris ended up with three wheels on his wagon after being hit by Pierre Gasly. So what did you make of that incident?
Yeah, that was, initially it looked like Gasly had just been a little bit clumsy after going off track, rejoining, a couple of cars go past, and then just sort of meandered into Norris as Norris was diving past on the left-hand side. But actually, got to give Gasly the benefit of the doubt. He was the one behind the wheel. He's best placed to really describe what was going on. His car had been assaulted by Alonso, and Gasly said that had damaged the right rear, and he'd continued to see if he could get away with it, basically, and just crack on. But he did notice it make a difference. And then on the lap in question with the incident with Norris, going at the end of that first sector as you come through those sort of fast sweeps, he'd gone onto the runoff a couple of times. Something was clearly up with the handle. And then he just said he was, you know, looking in his mirrors, trying to keep out of the way of all the other cars. He sort of suggested that he was struggling to keep it right. And then obviously, like, Norris comes by super quickly and there's just a really big impact. So barring any new information to what I have now, kind of giving Gasly the benefit of the doubt and saying it's just really unlucky. Not obviously Norris is helpless there. I don't really think he could realistically have expected Gasly to keep moving over to the left. I don't think there was really any outward sign or body language from the car that suggested that it was just sort of like constantly drifting across, and maybe there was a bit more space Norris could have moved into, but he said, you know, what am I meant to do, just drive up next to the wall for no reason? He didn't think there was any justification for giving any more space than he did. So yeah, it just compounded what turned into a difficult race for him, because he'd I think got himself into a little bit of traffic and a DRS train and was just struggling to make progress again after a slightly difficult first in, and I think a slightly early stop compared to some of the others. So I think he just ended up in a position where there were a couple of points on offer for McLaren and Norris, but it would have been hard work to even just to get into the top 10 properly. So one of those things where it's a big hit, quite a dramatic incident, but ultimately McLaren didn't really lose a great deal in that race because they just weren't very competitive.
Yeah, he stopped on lap 16 and ended up stuck behind Ocon, who was running along first stint. So that made things a little bit more difficult for Gasly. Best AlphaTauri qualifying performance of the season, though, for him. Seventh. I think he pulled out a lap that's something like 6 tenths faster than anything he'd done at the end of Q3. So he's pretty happy with that. And yeah, he was battling on, would have picked up a minor result, I think. But difficult race for him. But then again, Yuki Tsunoda, his teammate, had a very difficult race as well. He ended up down in 12th place, just dropped back at the start, just struggling with the tyres. Just a very, very difficult afternoon.
Yeah, I would like to, just because I've noticed it while checking a couple of things on the results sheet, I'd like to amend slightly something I'd said about Alonso and being unlucky, because I just felt, you know, he giving up 3 temps ultimately felt like it was quite harsh. Actually having a look at what 3 temps gave him after the original 5 second penalty was applied, it does make a difference. It does make a difference to his result. So I think, I'm not sure that really played into it, but I'd have to go and look at the steward's verdict properly. But just looking at that, you kind of, in the moment, you think, what difference does three attempts make? But then actually looking at the results sheet, it's the difference between 1 or 2 places for Alonso. So I think it's actually fair to throw the book at someone. That is exactly what that rule is there to do, isn't it? It's to stop people gaining a lasting advantage. And if you've got a 5 second time penalty and you sneak inside 1 or 2 positions by 3 tenths of a second within that 5 second time penalty, I think it's fine to be given another one.
Haven't we mentioned Nicholas Latifi finished 14th, carrying a little bit of weight in that car because he's got quite a few repaired parts on it. Probably his best qualifying performance of the season, to be not far off. Albon, Zhou Guan Yu retired early on with a water pump problem. First time he hasn't made Q2, so not the best weekend for him. But inevitably, we've had quite a few questions about the circuit and the events. So I think probably the best thing to do is I'll read out some of the questions and comments we've had, and then maybe we can have a chat that addresses all of it. Sander Van Hulten said, is F1 becoming too much show and not so much about the racing? I felt like the whole Miami GP was hyped up and had so many cringeworthy moments post-race. The interviews, police escorts, football helmets. This was all show, whereas 3/4 of the race had hardly anything happening. Sean Rooney said, do you feel this was a weekend where F1 lent too heavily into the spectacle in the way that distracted from the race? Daniel Booth said, so Liberty Media are obviously doing well in terms of boosting the popularity of the sport. But what on earth was this joke of an event? Everyone jokes about Caesar's Palace car park track, but as a TV viewer, this was no different. A mostly dull race, save for a crash and a couple of DRS overtakes. The fake marina just proves that Monaco, for all its faults, cannot be replicated or replaced for its genuine glitz and glamour. The celebrities were there for some reason. The post-race interview was conducted by someone who had definitely never seen a car race, never mind F1 before. And this farce of a podium ceremony. Words escape me. F1 should be better than this. I think Daniel wasn't keen on this race. That's the impression I get. And finally, Chris Parrott says, wow, what a terrible race. The track surface was appalling. There was no overtaking. And what action there was ruined by some unusually situated pleasure boats. Is the Miami Grand Prix 2022 F1's biggest lesson in waiting until the race is over before judging the event? Well, Mark, let's start with you. Lots of different perspectives to get into there. Show over substance. Do you think there's anything to that?
Well, I'd make the distinction between how it's been presented on TV and the peripheral stuff that's going on around it. When you're there and working, you don't necessarily get exposed to that. It's something that's going on in the background while you're doing your normal work. So, for me, it felt like an event with a great buzz. And it was certainly the busiest paddock I've ever been in. And you just couldn't get moved in the paddock. It was wall to wall, with guests and celebrities and stuff like that. But it doesn't bother me at all. But each to their own, and if it was presented in a way that perhaps got in the way of people's enjoyment of the race itself, well, I guess that's a fair viewpoint, but it's not something I felt. As for the post-race interviews, it was Willie T. Ribbs. Of course he's seen a race. He was 1977 British Formula 4 junior champion. He's tested a Brabham F1 car, and he's not a professional broadcaster, but I thought he was fine. And I find it hard to take offence, really. I thought it was a great event.
I must admit, when I was reading that, I was thinking, who did those interviews? Because I didn't see them because I was off down to find drivers. I didn't realise it was Willie T. Ribbs. Yeah, he was a very, very good driver in his time. But, Scott, it wasn't a stunning circuit, was it? But it was a good event. I don't think the race was brilliant, but I don't think the race was quite as terrible as been made out. But then again, maybe that's because I watch a race in a slightly different way to some, because I'm always tracking lap times and that kind of thing. So perhaps I'm not the best judge of it. What did you make of it?
I thought the race was okay. I thought it was pretty much middle of the road. I've seen worse Grand Prix. I've seen a lot better Grand Prix, certainly. There's definitely a disconnect when you're not on site, because I said this in the build-up to... I wrote a piece in the build-up to the Grand Prix, feeling like this race just didn't feel like it was... that we weren't the target audience. And to be honest, the people listening to this podcast probably weren't the target audience either. And the people that are traditional fans, just they're not the target audience, because a race like this is almost entirely about the event around it. And I don't think all 23 races should be the same, but I do think all 23 races should have the sporting competition side at their heart. And events like this, I think, go dangerously close to getting that balance wrong. But that's a different discussion, because we could be here for another hour or so if we get into this too much. But I guess my point would be that I do sympathise certainly with the people that watch this on television, because I do think it was an inferior product watching it on television versus being on site. That was the point. It was meant to be a massive spectacle. It was a festival-like atmosphere. I've never seen the paddock like it. Everyone who went down to the grid said that they've not seen a starting grid like it as well. The track's actually quite good. I don't think the track's bad. There are a couple of parts that split opinion, the really slow section and the tight chicane, which actually grew on me as the weekend went on. I found it less offensive by the time of the Grand Prix. Certainly quite a tricky sequence of corners. The surface wasn't as bad as it had been on Friday and Saturday. We were really worried that we weren't going to see any racing at all, because it was so bad offline on Friday and Saturday. But that seemed to improve on Sunday as well. So I think there were actually a few positives to take away from it. It wasn't stellar, but you know, as a race, there was a pass for the lead in the opening few laps. The lead battle was not good. It definitely wasn't. But I don't think the track can be blamed for the fastest car making its way to the front, especially because the performance profiles of the two cars, once that Red Bull gets in front, it's very hard to pass because it's very fast in a straight line. But we did have a quite interesting midfield fight after that. Bottas keeping the Mercedes at bay, especially Lewis Hamilton, for the majority of the stint. Quite a fun fight for the lower points positions. You know, Grand Prix is about more than just the lead battle. So I thought there was enough going on for it to be okay. It wasn't the most captivating Grand Prix, but it wasn't as bad as the absolute worst case scenario that people seem to be latching onto.
There's probably a little bit of a backlash to F1 telling everyone how brilliant this event is, and everyone talking up how great it is, and probably people like us being here saying it's a wonderful event, because that's not great for everybody watching on television. So I do understand some of that pushback, but there'll be worse Grand Prix this year, no doubt. That's a reasonably standard Grand Prix, I would say.
Yeah, I don't think it was particularly offensive, but I would agree that it didn't live up to the hype. That was my big concern pre-weekend. I didn't see how the Grand Prix could live up to everything that was being promised. How could it? You would need one of the best events of the season, if not the best Grand Prix of the season, to really live up to how much this was being crammed down everybody's throat about how brilliant it is. And like I said, I bet that would be much, much harder to take if you were off site and you're being constantly told how brilliant this thing that you can't be at is.
Yeah, I think there was a little bit of that, and maybe that's something F1 can learn from for when we go to Las Vegas next year, although I suspect a very, very similar thing will happen. But one thing that F1 can't be faulted on is they have tried to build up a big event. It is really trying to capitalize on that growth of interest in the USA, and that's good for everyone ultimately. So overall, I think a net positive, but yeah, not perhaps the greatest events for those watching on television at home. But it's a broad church, 23 races on the calendar, so there should be space for multiple different kinds of events. And I'm sure the track will develop over time and should bed in a little bit better. Well, thanks very much, Scott Mitchell and Mark Hughes, for your insight. Head to therace.com and don't forget the hyphen, as there's huge amounts to read there about the Miami Grand Prix and the latest goings on in the world of Formula One. Check out our sister podcasts, including the Race IndyCar podcast, MotoGP podcast, got Formula E podcast as well. And if video is your thing, check out our YouTube channel. We're now going to turn our attention to the 2-week gap before Spain, but stay with us on the Race F1 podcast for everything you need to know from the world of Formula One.
The Athletic.